welcome to Talking History. This is your host, Brian LeBeau of Creighton University's Department of History. This week we finish our month-long series on presidential elections by talking to presidential scholar Fred Greenstein, who will share with us the lessons he has learned from his years of study of the men who have held that office. But before we talk to Professor Greenstein, let's take a look at an important event that occurred this week in history. During this week in 1970, Salvador Allende was inaugurated as Chile's new president, promising to bring radical social reform to the struggling working class. Allende learned the basic principles of socialism while working in a shoemaker's shop as a teenager. Determined to fulfill his father's dream of a Chilean socialist utopia, he began his political career in 1933 by joining the Chilean Socialist Party. He ran for president three times between 1952 and 1964, finally succeeding on his fourth try in 1970. As president, Allende confronted grave socioeconomic inequality at home and stiff economic sanctions abroad. On September 11, 1973, as the nation's economy experienced high levels of inflation and poverty, the conservative-backed National Army stormed the presidential palace and killed Allende. Chileans hoped his removal would spark a new era of prosperity and peace. Instead, it resulted in the nightmare dictatorial rule of Augusto Pinochet. One of the most prominent items in the news recently, relative to the upcoming presidential election, has been the Democratic Party's nomination of Joseph Lieberman, a conservative Jew, as its vice presidential candidate. For our History in the News segment, Leonard Dinnerstein gives us his thoughts on this historic development. Dinnerstein is a professor of history at the University of Arizona, director of Judaic Studies, and the author of Anti-Semitism in America.
The nomination of Senator Joseph Lieberman of Connecticut to run for the vice presidency on the Democratic ticket headed by Al Gore has brought forth many comments. Bold and imaginative are two of the words used in praise of this senator, even though Lieberman, as a moderate to conservative, is neither. Many Jews and media people, however, are concerned that Lieberman, the first Jew to run for the vice presidency, might incite outbursts of anti-Semitism and cause the Democrats to suffer at the polls. Nothing could be further from the truth. Anyone who is anti-Semitic is likely to be voting for Pat Buchanan or George Bush. Vice presidential candidates, moreover, rarely add or subtract votes from a ticket. In this case, however, Al Gore's selection of Lieberman to run with him might help the party win the election. Ordinarily, about 80% of the Jewish vote goes to the Democratic candidate for the White House. During the Reagan years, only about 65% of the vote went Democratic. In 1992 and 1996, Clinton polled about 80% of the Jewish vote. I think, however, that with a Jew running who might possibly become president, a number of Jews who might otherwise have supported Bush will pull the Democratic lever when they get into the voting booth. There is a sense of great satisfaction amongst Jews that finally one of them might possibly make it to the White House. The key states in this election will be Florida, Pennsylvania, Ohio, and Illinois. Whoever carries those states will be our next president. Jews constitute anywhere from 2 to 6% of the vote in these states. If 5 or 6% of the Jews who might otherwise have voted Republican switch their votes, and the elections in any or all of these states are close, then the Jewish vote might be enough to allow Democrats to carry those states. Thus, instead of being a handicap to the ticket, I think the fact that Lieberman is Jewish will not only add excitement to the campaign, but may be just what Gore needs to win the White House.
Thank you.
This is the final segment in our series on the American presidency. For the past 4 weeks, we've looked at key elections in American history, as well as the qualities that have led to success or failure in that office. Today, we sum it all up with the help of Fred Greenstein, author of The Presidential Difference, Leadership Style from FDR to Clinton, published by Free Press. Fred Greenstein is professor of politics at Princeton University and director of Princeton's Woodrow Wilson School Program in Leadership Studies. Welcome, Professor Greenstein.
I'm happy to be with you.
Well, we're glad to have you. In your book, you list several criteria by which you analyze presidential leadership style and really success in office. Let me list them for you one at a time, and maybe you could briefly explain them. Okay, let's start with public communication.
By public communication, I'm referring to what Teddy Roosevelt called the bully pulpit, the ability of the president to get the message out to the people, to lead, inspire, and communicate. And this, I think, is just a key part of the presidential job. Mm-hmm.
Organizational capacity.
Now, this, I think, is one of the rarest things in the presidency. We select people who have been on Capitol Hill, some of whom have been governors of very small states, and that just does not provide a lot of organizational ability. But a disorganized presidency can be a prescription for disaster, as it was when Kennedy's chaotic processes led to the failed invasion of Cuba at the Bay of Pigs. And here, I think the great benchmark president is Dwight Eisenhower, who had enormous organizational experience in World War II.
We'll come back to a few examples later on, but let's continue down the list. What about political skill?
The founding fathers really created a system which was not meant to produce results, but in the modern era, we have to get results out of our political system. We have to deal with the health of our people, with the material needs of the nation, and to do that, you need a person in the White House who can really bargain and maneuver and put pieces together. So I think that's a crucial part of a presidency.
Vision?
Well, vision is a term that I take from someone we'll be talking about a little more, namely George Herbert Walker Bush, President. President Bush once lightly said that, well, he didn't have the vision thing, meaning that he didn't think in terms of larger pictures and larger directions. Well, it's important that a president be skilled, as I was saying, but the most skilled of the modern presidents, Lyndon Johnson, the great Texas Wheeler dealer, had very little sense of policy direction, especially in foreign policy, and as a result, he very unwisely entered into an ill-defined war in Vietnam, which destroyed his presidency and still scars our nation. So vision is a sense of direction and ability to advance workable and desirable policies.
Okay, good. Cognitive style?
Well, the mind has two sides, the thinking and feeling side, and of course cognition is the term used for thinking. So it's important to know of a candidate or of a president, how does that person think and process information? Presidents vary in basic intelligence, and they vary, I think, in terms of whether they can see the big picture or whether they get lost in minutiae.
Okay, and your final criteria, something that's become quite well-known in the news lately and controversial, emotional intelligence.
Yeah, this term almost seems like a contradiction in terms, having emotion and intelligence in the same phrase, but it's a term that's been introduced wisely, I think, to account for the fact that you get very, very bright people who nevertheless mess up because their emotions are not under their control. And we're going to get into the case of President Clinton, who then inevitably referred to the Lewinsky affair, and I think his larger sense of being undirected. So I think it's a problem if we have an emotionally unintelligent president, especially in a nation where the chief executive has his finger on the nuclear button.
Now, you've listed six criteria, which do you believe is the most important?
I think the rock bottom most important one is emotional intelligence, and that sometimes translates into the notion of character. The character of the president is a fundamental requirement for effective and creative leadership. Without that, I think the other things can just be, not pay off for the nation and for the administration's legacy.
Okay, let's apply a bit of this. Now, in your book, you cover American presidents from Roosevelt, Franklin Roosevelt, to Clinton, and we've covered a number of these presidents already in our series, but let's take a look at those presidents we haven't covered yet and that are in your book. Let's start with the person to whom you referred earlier, John Kennedy.
Okay, I call my chapter on Kennedy, Coming to Terms with Kennedy, and I'm interested in frightening dilemma. This is a man who we now know was very reckless in his private life. Even as president, he was a womanizer of colossal proportions and brought females into the White House really quite indiscriminately. Now, he also was president during the nearest thing to a nuclear apocalypse in history, the Cuban Missile Crisis of 1962. So was the private riskiness associated with public riskiness. Now, lowering the microscope, as I and others have done on the missile crisis, we see, in fact, that he was very cautious there. He was cautious with the Soviets in general. So there was a compartmentalization there. This was a careful, responsible president who was irresponsible in his private life. And if he had not been assassinated, maybe one would have spilled over into the other. We'll never know the answer to that. So in a curious way, even though I think there's something emotionally unsound about being as privately reckless as he was, from a performance standpoint, he was emotionally intelligent in that he didn't put those pieces. He controlled his emotions where it counted for the American people.
Let me stay with that a moment, because I think you're addressing a very important question people raise when they think about which candidates they're going to support, and that is that relationship between private life and effectiveness in office. It certainly came up in the Clinton matter where we questioned, well, really does it matter what he was doing in his own time with Monica Lewinsky or whomever. Do you see a relationship here? Is this something we ought to be concerned with, or does private life not matter?
I think the president is such an important figure that everything we can find out about him, we should take account of. We shouldn't blind our eye out of a sense of, this isn't quite right. It isn't cricket. If you choose to be president or run for president, you surrender a certain element of privacy. And to take the Clinton example, an entire year was taken out of the Clinton administration by the impeachment scandal and fallout from the Lewinsky episode. But beyond that, the presidency itself was weakened. By the end of the year, a precedent had been established in which the president's private secretary and even the Secret Service aides could testify about things that happened in private in the White House. Now, that, I think, is a prescription for failing to have good, rigorous consultations within your presidency. So I think the private thing, really, we can see in the Clinton case that it was problematic. And I think if Kennedy had gone on for two terms, the Russians or the Republicans would have made something about his private life as well. Not Clinton. Kennedy, I mean, of course.
Okay, and what about Gerald Ford?
Now, Ford, I think, is a bit of a surprise. Of the 11 modern presidents, one who people almost forget about is Gerald Ford. He served a little more than 800 days. He's the only person in American history to serve as president who was never elected either to president or vice president. He had been appointed by Nixon, and he became an object of humor, and I think partly because of his halting way of expressing himself. People underestimated him. But as I looked at his presidency, I found a person of enormous integrity, a person whose emotions were rock solid, who really had a great mastery of his administration's policies. I found, for instance, that Alan Greenspan, who had been chairman of the Council of Economic Advisers under Ford, remembers him as a person of great great responsibility. The other thing about Ford was that after this poorly thought-through pardon of Richard Nixon, he bounced back and organized his presidency in quite an effective way. I think the man who followed him, Jimmy Carter, and the man in the White House now, Bill Clinton, could have learned a lot about the responsible and rigorous organization of the Ford presidency. So there are lessons to be taken from this man who will never appear on Mount Rushmore.
George Herbert Walker Bush.
Well, he's another non-candidate for Mount Rushmore, but a person with a lot of strong qualities. He was described, as he came up for the presidency, as the man with the perfect resume. He had run for the Senate twice. He'd spent 2 terms in the House of Representatives. He'd been chairman of the Republican Party, head of the CIA, representative of the nation to China. He had been vice president for 8 years. And what you see is a lot of working competence, skill, particularly in building the coalition against Saddam Hussein that led to the 100-day victory and the 100-hour victory in the Persian Gulf War. But I view him as an inbox president. That is, someone who didn't, his lack of the vision thing we talked about before, he didn't give his presidency a sense of direction. He also downplayed rhetoric and communication. He was really intimidated by following the great communicator Ronald Reagan, and the result was that in the fourth year of a presidency in which his popularity was higher than that of any of his predecessors, the economy went bad, and he simply was unable to persuade the nation that he was entitled to a second term.
Well, we asked you to come on the program today to really help us summarize what we've been talking about for the past month. So let me, in the very few minutes we have left, simply ask you, because you addressed this in your concluding chapter, what have we learned from the modern presidency that we ought to keep in mind?
Well, let me start by reminding us all of the great aphorism of George Santayana, that those who fail to learn from the past are condemned to repeat it. I think the history of the presidency is an invaluable legacy, and I see many instances in which if presidents understood what had gone on before, they would have done a better job. Kennedy might have avoided the Bay of Pigs if he had seriously looked at Eisenhower's wonderful White House organization. Clinton might have avoided the disaster of his health plan if he'd looked at the way Jimmy Carter presided over an abortive energy program that had similar flaws to it. I believe we learned that we need skill, but it has to be joined to vision. We certainly want an intelligent and thoughtful person, but that thoughtfulness has to be wed to emotional intelligence. The combination, I think, that makes for integrity and an ability to have a sense of direction, especially if the president also works hard to communicate with the American people, to inspire them and teach them and lead them.
What do we look for in a candidate? How do we judge this? What signs do we have with these particular skills?
Very good question. It's very hard to know for sure. But the campaign is a little bit like these pressure tunnels that they put models of airplanes in to see what their flaws are. If a campaign is organization is chaotic and people are dismissed and so on, this suggests a chaotic White House. The campaign in its nature is a communication process. So as the pressure builds up and as there are debates, as we have almost invariably now had, you get a sense of whether the preaching and teaching side of the presidency will be carried out by this individual. If there are lots of gaffes and errors of one kind or another, you begin to have a low expectation of the president's cognitive capacity. And then on emotions, sometimes a campaign can just flush out great emotional flaws. A famous episode was that of Richard Nixon, who ran for governor of California in 1992, which was not itself a wise move. He'd been defeated in 1960 and did become president in 68. But Nixon blew up under the campaign pressures. He accused the press, as he put it, of giving him the shaft. He said he was in the process of giving his last press conference. That proved to be inaccurate, but it was a good indication of a man with major emotional flaws, and this came out in the unnecessary excesses that led into Watergate and the end of his presidency.
Well, thank you. I'm afraid we have to leave it at that. We're out of time, but I certainly would recommend to our listeners that The Presidential Difference is must reading if you really want to understand presidential elections, and I hope we'll take a look at it. You've been listening to Fred Greenstein, Princeton Professor of Politics and the author of The Presidential Difference, Leadership Style from FDR to Clinton. This is Talking History. For our final op-ed in this series on the American presidency, we take a look at President Jimmy Carter. Here to examine his term in office is Stephen Hess. Hess is a senior fellow at the Brookings Institution in Washington, D.C.
Let us assume that Jimmy Carter was an intelligent, decent, hardworking man. Assume, moreover, that he appointed to his cabinet and sub-cabinet many men and women who were experienced and dedicated. How then could a president, certainly no less mentally alert than most past presidents, with many advisors of high caliber, produce such an undistinguished presidency? I'd like to put forward the theory that the root of the problem is that Jimmy Carter was the first process president in American history. Process president, using a definition by Aaron Wadowski and Jack Knott, means that Carter placed greater emphasis on methods, procedures, and instruments for making policy than on the content of the policy itself. Carter was an activist. He wanted to do things. Yet his campaign statements should have warned us that save for the human rights thrust in foreign policy, his passion in government was more for how things were done rather than what should have been done. He believed that if the process was good, the product would be good. In other words, if he set up a procedure for making policy that was open, comprehensive, his favorite word, and involved good people, whatever came out of this pipeline would be acceptable within certain budgetary limits. A concern for process is not a bad thing. Some past presidents made a fetish of chaos in policy development, often resulting in proposals that had not been fully explored. But process is only a tool for getting from here to there. It is not a substitute for substance. And good processes can produce conflicting, competing, confusing programs. When a president lacks an overriding design for what he wants government to do, his department chiefs are forced to prepare presidential options in a vacuum. Usually this is done by BOGSAT, the acronym for a bunch of guys sitting around a table. In other cases, where political executives have not been given some framework in which to function, they will impose their own hidden agendas on the president. Furthermore, uncertainty radiating from the top lowers morale throughout the permanent government. Hence, it adversely affects the implementation of programs. While the bureaucracy may be the butt of jokes, it is also the motor force that provides services on a day-to-day basis. And it, too, looks for consistent signs from a president. American presidents have not been ideologues, and it is certainly not my notion that Carter should have become one. But all modern presidents, whether liberal or conservative, no matter what their other faults, have had some programmatic view of government in which the specific parts could usually be fitted. This was not the case with Carter's domestic program, although he seems to have had a firmer view of defense policy, perhaps because of his naval background. What produced an undistinguished presidency? Jimmy Carter's failure to set consistent policy goals, or more grandly, a philosophy for government.
You've been listening to Stephen Hess, a senior fellow at the Brookings Institute in Washington, D.C. This is Talking History. For our historic site of the week, we'd like to recommend two free websites where you can learn more about presidential elections. Here to tell you about them is Talking History's Cindy Workman.
Harper's Weekly website, harpweek.com, has announced two new websites on presidential elections. The first looks at presidential elections from 1860 to 1884 and features political cartoons and prints rich in the political images of the 19th century. Each cartoon and print is accompanied by a note explaining the historical context, identifies the people and events, and interprets the symbols and artistic perspective. The political print site provides internet access to the collection from the Library of Congress and is one of the most important collections of American political prints covering 1766 to 1876.
And finally, turning to our weekly segment, Coming Attractions, we'd like to alert you to a major exhibit featuring portraits of the American presidents. Portrait of a Nation, organized by the National Portrait Gallery, just opened at its first venue, the George Bush Presidential Library in College Station, Texas. It will run there until January 15, 2001, but it has several other stops planned throughout the year through January 12, 2003. Contact the National Portrait Gallery for further information. And that's it for another week of Talking History. I hope you've enjoyed our program and that you will join us next week when we take a look at the man whom Dwight Eisenhower credited with winning World War II, Andrew Jackson Higgins. Until then, we invite you to send us your comments or suggestions by email at talkinghistory@creighton.edu. From the studios of KIOS-FM in Omaha, Nebraska, this is Brian LeBeau.